Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are master political strategist and founding partner of GBAO, Jim Gerstein, and the senior fellow at Eno Transportation and Logistics Professional, Jeff Davis. Now, remember, we'd love to take your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the links to our sponsors, Hold On Bags, Sleep Me by Chili Sleep, and Real Paper in the show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. James, you know, we talk about all the disagreements in Washington. There is one thing Republicans and Democrats agree on. The Medicare Trust Fund will be insolvent in 5 years or so, as it's pumping out more money than it's taken in. And that would trigger automatic sizable cuts. So what do you do about it? You got to do something about it, right? President Biden offered a serious proposal. Increase the Medicare tax that wealthy Americans pay on investment income from 3.8% to 5%. That's only on unearned income over $400,000. And also expand Medicare's ability to negotiate prescription drug prices to reduce cost. Republicans are outraged. Big tax, big government. Okay. It's such a bad idea. Kevin McCarthy and company, Mitch McConnell, tell us what you want to do instead to solve this problem that you admit looming insolvency. Now, the only other answer, James, is to cut benefits. And Democrats should be salivating over this debate. Should we increase taxes on the wealthy retiree making $1 million of investment net income, or cut the benefits that are tied to some working guy who's living on 40 grand? Bring it on, James.
Well, not only I think you should bring it on, but you got to bring it on with consistency and repetition. All right. Just because you pointed out, or we pointed out on this show, or somebody goes on cable TV and points it out, that's not going to do you any good. You got to do visuals. I agree. It's like, plus it's such insane public policy to negotiate, you know, a set of tires. I mean, you can't negotiate Medicare, but you're right on. But let's see if they have the discipline and the tenacity to just keep hammering this home. And what they should do is start running national ads in swing states right now. And just make them as uncomfortable as you can possibly make them.
I couldn't agree more. What you can't do is just watch the Republicans wallow in their agony, and they are wallowing. You got to make a positive case. But anything the Republicans try to do on Medicare or Social Security is going to cause hell. Trump already has said, keep your hands off these, while the right-wing crazies want to slash them. And you know, James, the other issue is Medicaid, which Republicans never are able to understand is just as popular as Medicare. So North Carolina, that right-wing legislature, Republican legislature, for years has resisted accepting going along with Governor Cooper's pressure to become the 41st state to accept Obamacare's expansion of Medicaid benefits. They have now capitulated. They are giving in. It's every time it's on the ballot, Idaho, Missouri, South Dakota, Oklahoma, it carries. Time is against the holdouts. You know, our guest a few weeks ago, Brandon Presley in Mississippi, what a great issue for him down there. Mississippi is now will be one of 10 states that has not taken Medicaid expansion, and they got 30 rural hospitals closing. I mean, these are great issues for Democrats.
So as a child of rural America, let me point out something. So you have Mississippi. Let's say you have Amy, Mississippi. I don't know, just pick any town that you want. Macomb. And since you have a hospital, a rural hospital, that hospital a lot of them can't make it without Medicaid expansion because so much of their population base is on Medicaid because it's a very poor part of the country for very explainable reasons. But it's not just that the poor people that live there are not are going to be denied health care or health care with anything proximate to them, the non-poor people. You know, they're lawyers in Amory and Macomb. They're dentists there. They're CPAs. They're school teachers. They're librarians. There are all kinds of people who are not, they're policemen, fire people, whatever. They, when the rural hospital closes and they got to go another 50 miles to get treated for a heart attack or an accident injury, the impact of this is way beyond, because a lot of people probably, yeah, it's going to hurt some goddamn people on paying their tax, of course, it's cruelty is the kind of point of it.
Right.
But it just, it doesn't just affect people, quote, like that, unquote, which is, you know, get what I'm saying. It affects everybody.
Well, it does. And the other thing is that the Medicaid benefits just don't go to what we consider poor people. They go to some working class, middle class people. The fringe, figure, Russ Voigt, who was Trump's last budget director, he's now peddling this idea to House Republicans to require work requirements for all of the social programs, including Medicaid. James, there are 40 million women covered by Medicaid in their pregnancy and in birth. So what's Mr. Voigt going to do? Have them waiting tables as they go into the delivery room? This is Medicare is a terrible issue for Republicans. Medicaid is just as bad.
So let me give you another example where Medicaid, and I think whatever can help poor people, you don't get me wrong, but where most everyone has a stake in that. Let's say I'm 60 years old, I'm retired, I'm married. My wife and I have $175,000 in the bank, and through part-time work and retirement benefits, we're making $35,000 a year, all right? But if one of our parents needs long-term medical care, they can, by stripping the assets down to $20,000 or less, as we well should, their parents can live their life out in dignity and not break their children. And this applies across the board. I can't tell you the number of people in approaching old age who would be utterly destroyed by having to pay for long-term health care. You know, this thing works. It affects people, and it's not just who they want you to believe in. I don't believe there's any such thing as the undeserving poor. Okay, that's just not something that I use, but to get into the nomenclature of the moment, that's what they're trying to convince their voters of, which is totally bullshit. Totally. And you know, I don't know how you got to make the case consistently, and you got to push it forward. But you know, real examples of people who would be, you know, who retired policemen, shit, a retired gunnery sergeant,
right?
You'd drive that guy broke, or her.
Absolutely,
a lot of women retired.
You know, James, let me give you another one. You remember all the ranting and raving from Kevin McCarthy and company about the extra money Democrats voted for the under-resourced Internal Revenue Service last year? Some early returns are in, the Washington Post reports. The IRS is now answering 90% of its phone calls. It's covered its backlog of overdue returns. And while developing new software, because of this money, has processed over 99% of tax returns this season. That sounds like a pretty good investment to me, James Carville.
It's an excellent investment. And you know, it's the oldest thing in the world. The Republican government program, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the show, they starve it of funding, and then they claim it doesn't work. Well, what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I think I'm right on this. You can correct me, but I think you studied this issue. This actually cuts the deficit.
It does.
When you spend money on this, it actually brings in more revenue than it goes out.
Right.
I think.
Absolutely.
Am I right?
The Republicans' move to repeal it would have added, I think I have this figure right, 115 billion, I get my millions and billions mixed up sometimes, James, but $115 billion to the deficit. I mean, it's just, it's It's amazing. The reason it increases revenue is because they're not going after, you know, the small businessman or the farmer or the working stiff making 52 grand a year. They are wealthy people who don't pay taxes. They either cheat or, right. or they find, you know, dubious loopholes. Those are the people they're going at. Those people, when they avoid taxes, that means one of two things. Either others pay more or you have a bigger deficit. That's the only option.
Correct.
So...
Well, thank you for explaining it, but I knew that I'd read that. I know you told me that, and you follow these issues pretty close. It's just insane.
It is. What else is on your mind, James Carville?
I don't know. I guess the whole we'll probably talk about in the Q&A, the whole Fox Dominion stuff. It's just going to go on and on and on and on. But I guess what's on my mind to ask you this. The House Republicans keep saying that they're going to produce a budget. Okay. We haven't seen one. You've covered more budgets and talked to more people, Bob Greenstein, people that know this. Do you think they're going to actually produce a budget one day?
At some point, they have to. There will be a budget. I think it'll be one of the phoniest budgets you've ever seen. They're going to make, you know, assumptions. They're going to talk about freezing programs, which are cuts, of course. They're going to slash spending for the poor. I mean, they're really poor. They really are. They can't touch entitlements, and they can't touch defense. If you can't touch entitlements and you can't touch defense, and you're not going to raise any taxes, and balancing the budget is one of those, as we say, impossible acts.
So let me go follow through with this a little bit and understand a little better, and I think our listeners can understand a little bit. All fiscal bills have to originate in the House, constitutionally. That's correct.
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So
Russell Long never accepted that, but that basically is correct, James. Yes.
Okay. So. They can produce a budget or they can just pass a budget like at 3 o'clock in the morning. Right?
Right. Right.
Then you can pick it apart all that you want because at some point they have to go on the record and they have to start. And so they start there and of course the Senate is not going to go along with it. And then something passes the Senate and then they have conference committee and you know, that gets out. But, the point here is we can hold them to the fire because they got to produce a budget. Either put one out or they got to pass one, which is just as bad.
No question. They have to. And they are tormented by this. I mean, what they privately would like to do is cut Social Security and Medicare, and some of them even want to cut the defense budget. You know, in the past years, I've been receptive to the idea of cutting the defense budget. But when we're going and the kind of money we're pouring in, I think, for a good cause to Ukraine and trying to build up weapons, pretty hard to cut the defense budget right now. And they have an absolutely impossible act. I mean, it's kind of like that old expression when people are told to go do something to themselves that it's impossible to do. That's what Republicans are going through right now.
You know, so back to Ukraine, did Russians, at least from what I'm reading about this, Battle of Bakhmut or whatever, they're just suffering unbelievable losses. You just kind of wonder, when's that going to get back home? And when people start asking questions, I think we lost 55,000 people over, 10 years in the Vietnam War? Some people say they've lost 70,000 already.
Some people say that understates it. It could be as high as 100,000.
Right, right.
And they're half the size of a population that we had during the Vietnam War.
Yeah, they're keeping the news, the control of news or something, but you can't control somebody's fucking kid coming back home in a body bag. I don't know. I wonder if they're not closer to a breaking point than we think.
They are. I think what they've been doing, they're sending, you know, all their prisoners there. And they're taking people from, you know, Siberia and the outer provinces. There ain't many conscripts going in from Moscow. But after a while, that wears out. And so this battle, I think, is mainly a symbolic battle. If the Russians win it or they hold it, It's not that they've gained any new territory, and what the Ukrainians are trying to do are keep them bogged down until they begin their spring offensive. So, you know, I'm afraid it's going to go on for a long time, but Putin's not playing a strong hand right now.
Yeah, but my hope is sometimes things don't go very well, they don't go very well, and then one day they fall off the cliff. And there's some breaking point they have with the number of not just deaths, but if they got over 70,000 dead, how many people don't have an arm or leg or testicles or whatever the fuck gets blown up in wartime?
I hope
that we have the tenacity to stick this out, because I think they can win.
I do too. And when our friend Ann Applebaum gets back from Ukraine, where she is right now, let's see if we can get her on the program.
Absolutely, for sure.
Okay. All right.
Yes, sir.
Small things can lead to lasting change if we stop and say, hold on. Thank you, Hold On, for sponsoring this episode. You also can find the link in our show notes. James Jim Gerstein is one of America's great pollsters and political experts. It's great to have him on the show. It's at least the second, maybe the third time you've been on, Jim. And as well as American politics, you are very familiar personally and professionally with Israeli politics. And as the government there tries to strip the judiciary of its authority, there are massive protests, and it's profoundly depressed some close Israeli friends in America. Michael Bloomberg, who the former mayor, who is one of Israel's great friends, wrote the other day, and I'm going to quote, that Netanyahu is courting disaster, imperiling Israel's alliances around the world, its security in the region, its economy at home, and the very democracy upon which the country was built. Is this an existential threat for Israel?
I mean, it's no small statement for Michael Bloomberg to make. He's not a traditional critic of Israel, shall we say. And for him to be raising the alarm bells is very clearly showing how deep this is going into American Jewish society, American society, or American political discussion, and that a country that's shared, that's based its relationship with the United States on shared values, this is very alarming for people. And because it goes to the core of whether the two countries actually will share values in the near future. It's interesting, Al, so whether it's an existential threat, it depends who you ask, but it's pretty frightening. And you've got a lot of parallels, I'd say, to what's gone on in America in the last several years, during the Trump years.
I want to pick up on that, because Bibi Netanyahu, it seems to me, is a combination of Donald Trump. He's smarter than Trump, but in that he will do anything to stay in power. And also of Kevin McCarthy, in that he has to heed the craziest of the crazies in his coalition of nutbags, or they can throw him out. It's hard to see an off-ramp.
He is the unique figure in the world who can claim both Kevin McCarthy and Donald Trump standing. What happened is that Netanyahu won a very close election last November. It was the fifth election in just a matter of years, because like America, Israel is very evenly divided and very polarized. And so Netanyahu shares the weaknesses that McCarthy has, and that he's beholden to the most extremist elements in his country and in his and in the political in the political universe. So while he is beholden to three particular parties, of which he has appointed a finance minister who is the most extreme of the extreme. And this person has no qualifications to be finance minister. other than he can topple the government if he wants. That's right. Why he's finance minister. That's the ministry
he's wants. Israel's Marjorie Taylor Greene.
On steroids, yep. Actually. He called, well, she calls for, you know, she talks about Jewish lasers shooting from the skies. The finance minister of Israel just called to wipe out a Palestinian village that had just been rampaged by settlers, Jewish settlers, who went into this West Bank village. He has now managed to, he also calls himself a fascist homophobe. Proudly, he says, I'm a proud fascist homophobe. And this is the kind of person that Bibi is beholden to. I mean, it's nuts, and it would be funny if it weren't so serious.
Sure would be. You know, I think this puts President Biden in a very delicate position. He is a longtime huge supporter of Israel. His greatest leverage would be to threaten to cut off aid if they do this, but I don't think Biden's going to do that, which means he doesn't really have much leverage, does he?
He there's no signs that he is going to exert U.S. leverage over the Israeli government. And as much as I would like to see him as a strong supporter of Israel, my wife is from Israel, whose family is, you know, her entire family is there. I've lived there. I would love to see the U.S. government exert the pressure it needs to do to have an impact on Israeli policy, especially as it relates to the Palestinians, where it is an international issue. But here, where it's about the half the country in Israel needs America's help to stop the country from going into the, going down this path. So, but there's no, you know, it's unlikely that this is an issue that President Biden is going to put his political capital into. We've got a lot of our, you know, I would like him to, but I understand we've got a lot of issues here at home that he is focused on, as well as abroad. But they certainly won't do it. I don't think they'll do it aggressively out loud in public, because I think their assessment is that it's best to do it behind the scenes. Whether or not that is effective or not, I don't know. But
James?
So Jim, for benefit of our listeners, you and I go way back, way, way back. But I think I'd say this, working together, maybe the most favorite project we worked on was Israeli race in 1999. And it was quite glamorous. We were, you know, Danny Abraham's G4 and having dinner with Shimon Peres. And we won the goddamn thing, okay? I come out of the Catholic tradition and you come out of Jewish tradition. Neither one, which is known for its optimistic view of the world, but we actually thought, we were thinking like great things, that it was going to be a democracy from the Mediterranean to the Jordan, and the whole goddamn thing has turned into a disaster. How stupid were we?
I was so stupid that I thought Bibi Netanyahu, who we had just crushed in that election,
right?
But he was going to be a footnote in history. I will acknowledge that I was quite off.
Our youthful, naive, stupid fucking optimism. I'm thinking all the time, we're like on top of the world. We were going to dinner and, you know, in the Mediterranean and, you know, eating fresh produce and fish and shit.
I will say something that applies, actually, though, a brief story from then that applies to what Al just asked me. But I recall walking down the street with James in Tel Aviv, and people would come up to us. Let me clarify. They would come up to him, and they would recognize him. Just average, regular people walking down the street, not involved in politics or anything. And they would come up to him, and they'd say, "Thank you for coming here to save our country from Netanyahu." That was in 1999. And James turns to me and goes, "I don't know if it's me or what, but this country's like political Viagra."
It's the only place you can misplay. So, forever, and, you know, you've been to APAC, and I've done a bunch of events for them, and, you know, a lot of our friends have been really involved. And the argument is look, this is a beacon of democracy and our values in the Middle East. And when people see the great things that are happening in Israel, they want more for themselves. The United States has a historical commitment And we've given hundreds of billions of dollars in aid, which I traditionally have always been for. I still am, but that argument is not holding very good water today. They're going to have to think of something different and new, because that's the last thing that they seem to want to be, is a democracy.
Well, I'll say the organization in the United States that I think is most connected to making change in Israel, that wants to support the Israelis who are making change, is J Street, has actually changed its slogan from pro-Israel, pro-peace. This year they changed it to pro-Israel, pro-peace, pro-democracy, underscore the importance and the centrality of a strong democratic system to achieving peace, security, and a strong Israel. So, yes, the values piece is, and I think this is a lot of where Tom Friedman and Michael Bloomberg are going as well in the pieces that they're writing.
And I'll go back to Al, but the United States government, the government of Israel owes the United States. I mean, the Iron Dome, the aid, you know, now the Republicans talk about getting rid of foreign aid, which a lot of the foreign aid goes to Egypt, too. I mean, that you give Jimmy Carter, who's, you know, in a hospice now. I mean, but Camp David until has worked pretty good over the years.
I mean, yeah, it was the first country Israel made peace with, obviously, was Egypt.
Right.
And Egypt is not some small power in the Arab right. world.
No.
But the second piece of the Camp David Accords was the Palestinian peace.
Well, I'll start back now, just remember our naive, ill-informed, goofy, anti-historic optimism.
I'd say we had good reason, James, for optimism. I mean, we had a special person become prime minister.
He did.
Pete was somebody who was clearly
And we had a president of the United States that was dedicated to peace, and we almost became close, but...
It came close. It came very close.
All right, Albert.
Let me stay on this for a second, Jim. Why has the population, the voters, seemingly veered so to the right? The Labor Party of Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, Yitzhak Rabin, that's only a small party right now in the Knesset. So why is the country, I mean, I know it's divided, but you wouldn't have thought these crazies would have had any shot 20 years ago. I mean, is it the security threat? Is it cultural or religious? Do Orthodox multiply more? I don't know what.
It's a bit of an all of the above, but at the core of all of this, Al, is Netanyahu. He's highly identified with security there. Despite the fact that security experts and retired military and retired Shin Bet are against him, he projects an aura of security with a key part of the population. And what has happened is, this is where the Trump parallels come in. He has major legal problems. Trump is not yet indicted. Bibi is actually on trial right now. And it's going to last a long time. So everything kind of begins and ends with him trying to hold on to power. This is the parallel to Trump. You know, we've talked about McCarthy, but the parallel for Bibi to Trump is that everything begins with how can he stay in power and out of prison. And so he, like the Republican Party, he has a control over his voter, the Likud party voters, his party's voters, in a way that the other Likud politicians are afraid to go against him, just as the Republicans are afraid to go against Trump, because they fear the voters in their party. But if it were up to the Likud party, a lot of them would like to get rid of Bibi and form a broader coalition with the center left as a more of a unity oriented government that's focused on security. But they can't do it because they can't challenge Bibi, just as Kevin McCarthy can't challenge
Donald Trump. Parallels are really stunning, Jim. Let me turn to a couple American politics questions. When you look at your feeling thermometer now, Republicans and Democrats, how are they doing?
I mean, people are not happy with anybody. Voters are pretty unhappy with the parties and with politicians in general. more antipathy towards the Republicans. But I think that we've got a few events coming up in the next 3 or 4 weeks, culminating on April 4th, that will tell us a lot about where the country is right now, both the general public as well as the Democratic Party voters. We have the Wisconsin Supreme Court race coming up April 4th. This is about as good of bellwether as you can find, in that Wisconsin is the most evenly divided state in the country, or among them. You know, Biden won by about 20,000 votes. Trump had beaten Hillary Clinton by about 20,000 votes. We split a governor. You know, Democrats won the governorship, Republicans won the Senate seat in 2022. So, I mean, this is as purple as you can get. And we have an election, as the listeners of this podcast know. We have a Supreme Court race on April 4th in Wisconsin that's going to determine the balance of the court there. And I think, you know, as of now, I like the matchup that we have there. I think that our candidate is a strong candidate, Janet Prozewicz. She's a former prosecutor, former judge. And she is against basically the MAGA Republican who emerged, that the person from the MAGA movement. And he's in abortion is definitely popping up. You hear it from voters in focus groups. They know what's at stake here. And I think whether or not we see the dynamics and trends that emerged from 2022 to continue into 2023, this is a good bellwether. Or a good indicator, well, I should say.
We're going to certainly watch that. Let me try one more, and then I want to turn it back to James. You have a couple terrific young experts in your organization on the Hispanic vote. They were very helpful to me during the campaign. Your take both on what happened with the Hispanic vote in 2022 and looking ahead to next time.
Sure, and you're referring to my colleagues, Anna Iberwiri, who James knows well. And Michelle Mayorga, who's in New Mexico, and another
they
great colleague of mine. I think Hispanic voters are a diverse population. The first thing that people tell you is it's a diverse population, and it's not a monolith. And you're going to, you know, Hispanic voters in Florida, which is heavily Cuban, are different than Hispanic voters in Arizona, who are different than Hispanic voters in Illinois, and et cetera, et cetera. So, but what you do see is it is that they were also similar to the rest of the U.S. population in what was driving a lot of votes in 2022. We did independent expenditure campaigns in for the three House races in Nevada that the Democrats won. And it's a large Hispanic population, very important part of the vote and the coalition there. And I got to tell you, abortion was a big issue. People talked about, just that when they saw what happened with Dobbs, and that abortion was no longer available or no longer a guaranteed right, even in cases of rape, incest, or to save the life of the mother, the health of the mother, that overcame a lot of doubts that they had about Democrats in 2022. And I think we've talked about this before, but we were headed to massive, massive losses in 2022 driven by the history of first midterm election, all that. And then the Dobbs decision came out. And, you know, it was a horrible thing for people across the country. I've never seen a single event in my career change the political dynamics of a election that, aside from 9/11, which was obviously very different and very different for many different reasons, was just a completely different issue and consequence. But those are the only things that I've seen that where a single event or a single decision completely transformed the political dynamics. And that played with white voters, it played with black voters, and it played with Hispanic voters. But especially in these key races, it was very impactful,
James,
with Hispanic voters.
So Jim, earlier in the week we talked about Wisconsin, and you said, yeah, you kind of like our positioning pretty good. Last night, I ran into Ben Wickler, who's the chairman of the party. And his assessment was, yeah, we're doing pretty well now, maybe a little bit less. And the Republican is up with a massive TV buy because there's family in Wisconsin called the U-Lions, who are like the Koch brothers of God knows what. And that he said that he's got to start committing money now, and they have to hope that it's the end. I said, well, Ben, I'll tell you what, I'll be having Jim on a show tomorrow. And if you can, don't wait till the end. Send a check to our Supreme Court candidate in Wisconsin now, because the U-Lines are flooding the airways, and we don't have the option of budgeting from Election Day back. I guess that's my plea to all.
I think that's a very important plea. And the U-Lines, it is endless cash. They don't have to take a loan out here to make those donations. And Kelly is their guy, the Republican or the conservative.
Right.
That's the guy they wanted to win. And I believe they put in several million into the first round to help him.
And he's a really right winger. I mean, he doesn't try to hide at anything, does he?
No, not at all. I mean, he was a stop the steal lawyer after he lost his election in 20. He then went to go help the stop the steal folks from on the legal front.
Well, boy, I'll tell you what, Jim Gerstein here, he sees more Poland in U.S. politics, I'm sure, than anybody else, and obviously knows what's going on in Wisconsin. But I cannot tell our listeners how big this race is and how really important it is. And I'll just vouch for you on that one, Jim. And thank you for coming on the show. I think it's very important that I think our listeners are, you know, not just curious about Wisconsin, but are watching what's happening in Israel and with trepidation and fear. And it's something to be concerned about, and some fear is warranted, I think.
Yes, and I'll mention something else that just happened in Israel. It was in this morning's news in Israel. But as some folks who follow this closely know, the reservists make up a key piece of the Israeli army in general, but especially in the Air Force. And they had one of the squadrons was called up for reserve duty, and they said they don't want to report to reserve duty because of what's going on. And, you know, Al asked if this is an existential threat. I mean, this is tearing apart the fabric of the society. And the response to them saying they don't want to serve a dictatorship, they don't want to serve in something that's going in this direction, the response was that the Minister of Communications in Israel said, you know, they can go to hell. Okay, this is one of the most elite unions. That happens to be the same squadron of one of the most beloved prisoners of war missing in action pilots named Ron Arad, who disappeared back in the 80s and, yeah, is presumed dead. But his wife went on TV to say, or she went out and says, she said that, that the minister's telling them to go to hell. Let me just tell you, our family and their families have already been through hell to protect this country. I mean, it's a very powerful symbol.
Ooh,
yeah.
Wow.
And
Al couldn't find a pilot that would fly his criminal wife to Rome. All right, look, this is a deal that Israel's like, here. The more educated people can't stand Netanyahu as a general rule. Well, guess who's educated? Pilots. Yeah, they're educated people. By nature. They didn't just fall off the turnip truck. To fly a jet, a 777, requires some education and skill.
It's hard to call Air Force Squadron reservists some kind of anti-Israeli radicals. That's a heck of a story. And Jim Gerstein, I want to second James. You are a fabulous guest. Your expertise is extraordinary. And we want to get you back on soon.
Yes. We go from the Middle East to Middle America. And everything.
Well, it's always great to talk with you guys anytime. Great.
Thank you. Hey, James, our guest is one of the country's foremost transportation experts, Jeff Davis, senior fellow at the ENO, Transportation Think Tank. He knows rail, air, any mode of transportation. Jeff, boy, your topic is really in the news these days. Let's start with the Norfolk Southern train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. Republicans say the Biden administration was asleep at the switch. Democrats say this is what happens with sweeping deregulation. East Palestine residents are suing the railroad. Sort it out. Who's culpable?
Well, first of all, the railroad's going to pay whatever their results of their negligence are. However, it's important to know this happens quite a lot. There's an average of 3 railroad derailments a day somewhere. The big 7 Class 1 railroads have about 900 a day collectively. Most of those are west of the Mississippi River, where the tracks are very rural. And then the 800-odd other short railroads have a combination of about 200 a year. So you have 1,100 per year, about 3 a day. Only about 300 of those have any kind of a hazmat release. But for the most part, you know, they're fairly commonplace. As much as a automobile accident can vary from you running off the road and running and brushing up against the off-ramp to a major collision, there's various degrees of severity to these things. And from what I can tell, this one was just bad luck. The NTSB preliminary investigation has said that the guy in the cab hit the switch the minute to kill the brakes when he was supposed to, but the derailment was already in progress.
Well, are there any regulations or requirements that might have prevented this or future mishaps?
There are plenty of regulations. There weren't on this particular thing. What happened was that a bearing in there got too hot, and Norfolk Southern had bearing temperature sensors every 10 miles, but then there was a 20-mile gap. And during that 20-mile gap, it went from 70 degrees below the pay attention point to 50 degrees past the, oh, shit, hit the stop button and stop everything.
Right.
And so there are no current federal regulations about how close together those sensors should be. Norfolk Southern's already said they're going to start putting them closer together. And the bipartisan bill that came out with Sherrod Brown and J.D. Vance and John Fetterman and the rest would also force railroads to put those sensors closer together.
Yeah. You wrote, reading your site the other day, that there's been more than usual criticism of Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg as he's viewed as a potential political candidate someday. Now, I think he was slow off the mark. In a crisis, you always show up. But is the criticism of Buttigieg fair?
To some extent, Republicans are kind of changing the rules a bit. We don't really have much of a tradition in this country of the federal transportation secretary just showing up, you know, all the time there's a disaster. I think Freddie Pena did it a few times when he was secretary. There were a couple of plane crashes.
Right.
Well, for the most part, there's not a real tradition of them being, you know, the on-the-scenes person seen as the protector and helper because they're normally not running for office. This is the really unusual thing is that Buttigieg is seen as a serious contender in a post-Biden presidential race, and a lot of Republicans are kind of afraid of him. So a lot of this, I think, is just trying to get some damage done to him early before he can turn around and actually be running again in a few years.
Right. James Carville.
So Jeff, we talked earlier, and you said something that struck me is we're going to move to the airlines here, that U.S. air carriers do not have GPS. In other words,
the air traffic control still doesn't have GPS fully utilized in it. After a 15-year period, they finally got a system installed in the planes at the end of 2020, where that now all the planes, their little transponder is not just broadcasting the flight number, it's also broadcasting the GPS location, heading, and speed. So now that they're all broadcasting that and all the planes can receive it and send it, no one on the ground is really paying attention much to it yet. They're still in another 10, 15-year process of trying to get all the facilities on the ground to be able to read and relate to that data so that hopefully someday we can actually stack these guys in order and allow the planes to go between cities at the most efficient straight line, which would let them save fuel and be able to get more planes in the sky at the same time to meet demand in 10 or 15 years. So, but it's been a long time coming.
So every time that me, you, anybody listen to the show, Al, buys a plane ticket, don't we pay 7.5% extra tax to the federal government on the price of that plane ticket?
Yes, you pay a 7.5% tax on the base airfare, and also you pay $4.80 per leg. So if you change planes once in a single trip, you pay $9.60 there, plus some extra head charges on international and Alaska, Hawaii. And everyone's supposed to pay into this system somehow. So the air cargo guys pay, I think, 6.25% of the cost of the air, of the waybill to the cargo fees they charge. The general aviation guys pay a fuel tax. They're getting a little.
So where does this money go? I pay this. Yeah, I did. It's all including the ticket. You don't think about. Well, where does it go? Does it go to the general fund? Does it go to where?
There's an airport and airway trust fund started in 1970. It was the Lyndon Johnson administration's idea. They left it on the table. Nixon took it up, got it passed. And it collects all those aviation excise taxes and is supposed to use them for, first of all, capital spending for air traffic control, and then second of all, with what's left over, operational spending. And it's before COVID, it was taking in about $16 billion a year and spending about the same amount. COVID obviously did this three-year number on the receipts that are now hopefully – the Congressional Budget Office says that this is the year they'll come back to what they were pre-COVID.
So why, and people tell me that notice business to say that the technology that we have is less than optimal.
That is true. A lot of it's very old in the FAA facilities especially.
Right.
And it's a couple of reasons. It's partly because they are so safety conscious that once they get something tested and it passes the safety test, they're very hesitant to change to something else that might, until they can get it 100% passed. And the rate of change in computers is so fast that even once something's passed the safety test, it's becoming obsolete. The upside of that is that the longer the computers are the only thing where the longer you wait to buy something, you're actually getting more for your dollar instead of less. $1,000 spent on computers buys so much more than it did, power-wise, 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah. All right. Well, bottom line is I paid a lot into this fund, and I'm not sure that I'm getting, not just me, but every air traveler is getting the kind of technology they deserve. But at any rate, you help straighten us out, and thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day to be on the show. Thank you.
Well, there's one other thing you'd wanted me to mention if you wanted to.
Yeah, well, sure, go ahead.
We got to look at where we get this money and what it's doing, because right now, you notice that airlines are going to a lot of nickel and diming fees. They charge you ancillary fees for a seat change, more luggage, and all that kind of stuff. We're encouraging that because that 7.5% tax is on the base airfare, but it's not on the fees. So for every $25 that an airline switches over from having been base fare to getting out of fees, they save $1.88. And these are companies that they know how much money they're going to save on system-wide fuel costs for cutting each page out of the in-flight magazine. So, if the government's going to give them an incentive to do wrong, they're going to take it.
Jeff, let me ask you one more question before we go. I've been flying for almost 60 years, and as James Carville or my wife can attest, it's not a good experience to fly with me. I am a nervous flyer, and there's a lot of hassle at airports now. But as the incomparable Jim Fallows, who flies his own plane, notes, flying in Western Europe or North America today is safer than taking a walk or sitting in a chair.
Yes, it is. We haven't had a fatal accident on commercial aircraft air carriers in America since 2009 in Buffalo. And that is the one that caused them to increase the minimum number of flight hours to be at the stick as a co-pilot from 250 to 1,500. But we're so safe that now we're running out of pilots. So we're having trouble finding pilots who can meet that 1,500-hour max entry level, because they either got to have $70,000 to $100,000 to pay for private lessons or else we military. And the military is trying to retain theirs longer. So, you know, it all comes around. It's the safest system in the history of the world, but it is those same safety margins are making it harder to expand. And flights are going to get more crowded as a result and increasingly less comfortable.
I don't like any of that, but safety first. Anyway, Jeff Davis, you've been a terrific guest. Thank you so much. We've learned a lot.
You bet.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, you know, James, I have not been a big fan of North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis going back to his state legislative days and his first Senate campaign in 2014. Now, to be sure, he's a lot better than the state's new senator, Ted Budd, a real nutbag. But this week, I think Tillis really rose to the occasion. When asked about Fox News' Tucker Carlson's disingenuous, indeed dishonest, summary of videos of the January 6th violent assault on the Capitol, that was given to Carlson exclusively by Kevin McCarthy to placate his wingnuts, Carlson said his edited video showed it was really a come-by-eye moment, kind of like a Boy Scout jamboree with a few bad apples. This is the same faux journalist who said Fox News had to stop honestly reporting on the aftermath of the 2020 election because it was driving down the stock price. And he knew he didn't believe what Trump was saying. So when asked about all this, Senator Tillis had a very simple response. Bullshit.
I agree. I'm going to read from an article in the Washington Post, Dateline, Hazel Green, Kentucky. As he claimed the first spot in a mile-long line for free food in the Appalachian foothills, Danny Blair vividly recalled receiving the letter announcing his pandemic-era benefit to help buy groceries was about to be slashed. Kentucky lawmakers had voted to end the state's health emergency last spring by default, cutting food stamp benefits created to help vulnerable Americans like Blair weather the worst of COVID-19. Instead of a $200 a month, he would get just $30. He crumpled up the letter and threw it on the floor of his camper. All right. $200 a month to people in Appalachia so they don't have to spend in a mile-long line to get food. A mile long. I mean, think of how you get irritated. You go to a football game and you're sitting in line. Here you get in line, the most basic thing you can do in the United States. And I looked it up. It's in Madison County. It's 94% white. And it goes for Trump for 2-1. And that's not at all a reason why they shouldn't get it. But man, if people cut you off and are trying to starve you and you're still voting for them, I don't know. I'm just asking questions here. But this is like stunning. This is stunning.
You're asking a good one, James.
People sitting in line a mile long to eat.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
To just eat. And, you know, we shouldn't be punitive to people who we think make unwise political choices, but I just think this is the kind of thing that really brings it home. And I guarantee you that I know where Madison County is, and I bet there are 30 other counties in Kentucky just like that.
Yeah. Let's hope it changes. I'm dubious, but let's hope it changes.
I am too. I don't know how you get people's attention more than like them starving, but you might.
Right. All right, now for these great questions that we get from our fabulous listeners. This is a familiar one, James, but with a slightly new twist, and it's one that I know you care about a lot, as do I. Brendan in Apex, North Carolina, I think has written this before, wants to know the short and long-term prospects for North Carolina because she's tired of losing. However, she says they've got a newly elected state party chair, Anderson Clayton. It gives her hope for much-needed energy, vision, and organizational planning. Do you have any thoughts about that? I don't know Anderson Clayton. Do you know anything about her, James, or what they're doing in North Carolina?
I honestly do not. But I would have to say I'm generally not up to date on this. But I'm hopeful just the idea that maybe they're trying something a little bit different because in a lot of elections, they get close. They got close last time, but, you know, no cigar. And there has to be some more energy in a Democratic base in North Carolina. And it, you know, you've been on this for a long time, and I agree. It's the most promising state coming up that's not Arizona or Georgia.
Right.
And a lot of things portend well for Democrats in North Carolina. The migration patterns are very good. But we just got to accelerate this. And this governor's race is in. Of course, you're very big on this, and you're very correct. Man, you want to pick out the three races in the coming cycle other than president that's going to profoundly affect a lot of people's lives. It's not so much that you get – it's so great that you win the governorship or keep it in North Carolina. It's the utter disaster that befalls you if you lose it.
Boy.
Yeah?
Boy, you nailed that, James. If the Republicans control everything, the Supreme Court, which they took control of this year, the state legislature with that right-wing state legislature, if they get the governor's chair – it's only been, you know, thanks to North Carolina's really fabulous Governor Roy Cooper, who staved off a lot of this stuff, and as we mentioned earlier, has really kind of forced them into accepting Medicaid expansion. That saved North Carolina from a lot more grief, and that race between the Attorney General and if it's the crazy Lieutenant Governor is really important. And I think the two things that really have to happen in North Carolina, internally, the state has to work on getting more blacks registered and voting. They underperform, and they shouldn't. But outside groups that give money always view North Carolina as basically a red state. That's a mistake. In that Senate race last year, outside groups put out about fivefold more money than Republicans did than Democrats. So if those two things change, you're right. It is the most promising state that Trump carried in 2020.
Well, I've been in Manhattan raising money for the last 3 days, 2 days. And I talk a lot about North Carolina.
Yeah. Well, good, and good.
You know what? Because what you want is a place, you know, where the stakes in the election are huge, and you really got a chance, and the stakes are gigantic, and you really got a chance.
Right, right.
This guy, this Republican, the lieutenant governor, he's like loony in the goddamn tune. I mean, in looniness, he can hold his own with any of them.
Oh, he really can, and he's probably the odds-on favorite to get the nomination because they love loonies. And he's so vocal. You know, they elected a loony senator, but he or his people were smart enough, they hit him the whole campaign. This guy, Mark Robinson, doesn't like to hide. He likes to show his craziness out front, which is good.
I guess.
I mean, it's good for Democrats.
Right.
Anyway.
We're going to do everything I can to try to keep that seat.
Good.
The guy we got is good. I mean, it's not like, you know.
The Attorney General. Roy Cooper was the Attorney General before he was governor. I think Attorney General for maybe 12 years.
Well, what I know, Josh Stein, Josh Stein started Josh Shapiro's campaign.
Yeah, he really should.
Be aggressive.
Including the fact that he might have the same kind of opponent. Which is always helpful. The next question comes from Judy in Brooklyn, Maine. That's LIN. She said, someone should point out that Tucker Carlson and Fox once successfully defended against a libel suit by arguing the Carlson show is entertainment, not news. That would seem to undermine Fox's defense now that it deserves First Amendment protections as a news gathering outfit Fox can't have it both ways. And she says, incidentally, Al, I was once a worker bee in your Washington newsroom at Bloomberg. I sat fairly close to your desk in the corner of the newsroom. Judy, I hope it was a good experience. Don't tell us if it wasn't. I don't think you'd write in if it was a bad experience. But you're right about this. I mean, this is just this is not a serious news organization, you know, at least in prime time. And I must say, Brett Baer, who's a friend, has been hurt by some of the revelations that came out about him that didn't support their very solid fact data-based finding that Biden carried Arizona, which he did. But David Clark, a Fox executive, James, one time said that Hannity and Carlson's shows are not credible. That's not coming from the left. That's not coming from someone they've picked on. That's coming from their own executive, and it's so true.
You know, I'm trying to think, as you were talking, how to express this. And, of course, this lawsuit has exposed everything that any person with an IQ higher than room temperature would know. It's a total bullshit organization. They hate Trump. Trump hates them. They hate their viewers. Their viewers' loyalty to them extend only to the extent that they'll tell these viewers exactly what they want to hear. And you got even the, quote, good ones, unquote, saying we need to lie more. And if you think about it, the Arizona, Fox Arizona night election calls, probably most profound piece of political TV journalism, maybe that I can remember, because everybody thought Biden was losing. I mean, it was looked bad in Florida, and people were despondent. And all of a sudden, and pretty early in the night, these guys come up with the correct call. Not the Post, not the Times, not 538, not Cook, not anything. And, of course, they had to fire everybody.
Right.
It's a total...
They fired him for getting it right.
Yeah, right. Because they don't want it. The viewers in Brent Baer, in Tucker, in all of them are right. These people are not looking for the truth, you idiot. What are we doing this for? And they all know it. And they'll argue anything they want to argue in court. They say, well, just bullshit entertainment network. All right, and they'll do this. But the thing is, to the people that watch it, they don't give a shit. They don't give a shit that they hate them, that they belittle them, that they look down on them. You just tell me what I want to hear.
Right. That's absolutely true. Right.
While I'm waiting in line for my free food.
Okay. She said to me, James, we have Jeff in St. Pete, Florida, who says that you become more pessimistic the more correct you are. He agrees that offloading Harris will be a loose nuke event for the Democratic Party. That said, according to Jeff, Biden's not going to be reelected with Harris on the ticket, no matter who's the MAGA nominee. Any thoughts?
Oh, geez, Jeff, why do you ask me these questions, huh? Yeah. Can't you just go down there and, like, sleep on the beach there in St. Pete or something like that? You don't have anything better to do than make me squirm?
Torment you.
You know, first of all, you see it. Karen Finney did an interview with Puck about Tara Palmieri or something. I think that's right. And basically, you know, to disrespect Vice President Harris is an insult to the party's base, to black women everywhere. Yeah, this is nuts. And then my dear friend Donna Brazil wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. All right, any credit, she thought, boom, 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 you dare not touch her. I saw another prominent person, Democratic politics, actually was a white female, saying that, you know, to get rid of Harris would be an insult to women everywhere. I mean, they are mounting, in you and I know this is not opinion, this is fact. The Biden people really did not want her, but they did a good job of jamming them, and they're going to be jammed.
She's not going to be dropped. If he runs, he will run with Harris.
Yeah, I think that assessment seems to be a correct assessment.
And Harris will become more of an issue given Biden's age.
You can't say it don't matter who the vice president is if you're going to be 86 at the end
right.
of your term.
You can't.
You can't say age is not an issue. You can't say, let's pivot to the real issues here. Let's talk about prescription drug costs and let's talk about unemployment. No, you're correct. Those are issues, but age is an issue.
Yeah.
You're not going to talk people out of it.
And I'm sorry,
and
Karen.
Who the vice president is an issue. Yeah. You're not going to talk people out of it.
And whatever Karen Finney and Donna Brazile write and think, it's not what most Americans think now. Kamala Harris is held in pretty low regard by most Americans. And even a number of Democratic politicians will say to you, geez, you know, she just hasn't risen to the occasion. So, you know, maybe the next year she will, but she's got a way to go.
They were urged early in their term to make their focus crime. Your former prosecutor, your former attorney general, and they said, we can't do that. If Kamala Harris would have been the point person for this administration on crime and could have been for police reform, could be doing like town halls, talking to crime victims, you know, boom, 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 she'd be 12 points higher.
You know, you're absolutely right, and it's not too late, though. It would have been better if it had been done a year and a half ago, but it's not too late now. I mean, the Republicans are running big on crime everywhere, and if she's willing to do it, to be tough, you know, to be tough and make people accountable, but I don't think they're going to do it.
I just don't get it. And now, of course, to the point we think we discussed this, where Biden is, you know, not vetoing override legislation on the D.C. criminal code. This is just what it's come to. You're right. You got to get in front of it now. But, you know, I've been beating this drum forever. You know, wrote an op-ed piece 2 years ago in the Wall Street Journal urging Democrats to own this issue. And I got news for you. It's not going away anytime soon.
Ask Lori Lightfoot if you think it's going away.
Yes.
The mayor of Chicago who just got 17% of the vote.
17%.
Right.
The incumbent gets 17%. If you talk about something gets your attention in politics, an incumbent at 17%, you don't need James Carville to tell you that. That's a shitty number.
Hey, James, our next question comes from Mike in Annapolis, Maryland, which we agreed last week is one of our favorite capitals, maybe our favorite. And Mike asked, how is it possible that some of the most horrible and deceitful human beings on earth all ended up on the Senate Judiciary Committee? Is there any way we the people can do any oversight? Mike, you're right. I mean, that's Ted Cruz and Marsha Blackburn and Josh Hawley. It's a really motley crew. But, you know, I think I would pit the House Judiciary Committee. You know, they can go one-on-one. That has Jim Jordan and Daryl Issa and Matt Gaetz and Andy Biggs and Ken Buck. But I don't want to eliminate the House Oversight Committee from this worst and horrible and deceitful contest, because they not only have Jordan, who's really running the committee, they got a figurehead chairman. Jordan, they have Paul Gosar, they have Biggs, they have Scott Perry, the mastermind of trying to overturn the election last time. And to top it off, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert. I don't know. I think I'd pit them up against Cruz, Blackburn, and Hawley. James, what do you think?
I think that the rank-and-file Republican voter, not all, but a substantial number of them, are just dumb, trashy people. I'm sorry. I don't know how anybody can come to a different assessment, and it is not surprising that they elect people like you just brought out. These people hold office because the Republican rank and file wants non-thinking, extreme people who will constantly lie to them, and they're getting what they demand. And they're getting the politicians that they demand, and they're getting the news that they demand. This is the American capitalist system at work in American political system, producing the result that they want.
To go to the other side, John in Chicago and Laurel in Manhattan asked almost identical questions. They ask about J.B. Pritzker, who has a GDP of over $1 trillion. They say he's passed the $15 minimum wage. legalized recreational marijuana, passed a woman's access to abortion and gender-affirming care. He ended the cash bail system, banned assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And they both say Governor Pritzker has also raised the state bond rating to, I guess it's an A-minus, and extended health care to undocumented immigrants and passed a six-year, $40 billion infrastructure plan. Wow, I'm tired. Wouldn't Governor Pritzker be a serious presidential candidate if Biden doesn't run, James?
The answer is yes. And interesting thing, when we had Clinton folks on, who was Raphael Warnock's campaign manager, who's like hottest, you know, black guy from, you know, rural South Georgia, and he came up through Governor Pritzker's shop. He's a very aggressive guy. He's got a record. He's got a bank account. And he's got ambition. And if I were President Biden, I would want some assurance, and I'm not sure, I don't know if he'd get it, that he would not challenge me in 2024. Because he's making an awful lot of moves here, an awful lot of moves, and they're putting a lot of stuff out. Now, I'm sure what they would say is, well, just in case the president changes mind, we're getting in position to go. But whenever he may jump the light. That's not impossible.
Well, I'll tell you, you're right. The Democrats have a bunch of really impressive governors. I mean, more than any. It's really incredible. I mean, Pritzker is certainly one of them. And Roy Cooper is one. And Gretchen Whitmer is one. And Phil Murphy is one. And there are others. It's just a very, very.
That's what people don't understand. This happened to me twice yesterday in Manhattan. Well, James, I mean, I don't think Joe should run, but we don't have anybody. I'm like, are you crazy? But, you know, I tend to be a very patient guy because I leave after I've had two drinks. So I'm nice to him. Say, no, we actually got to. Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. And, you know, the voters saw. Because all they know, I love Joe Biden. Please, I couldn't be more admiring of him. He's like a great state school guy. He's like best record any president had this far into it. But man, please think about this.
You're right.
They go on anyway. And the voters
feel
the same
way. Break one of my rules here, James. Aaron, who just says he's in the USA, Aaron. I'm going to ask this question from you, but it's the last time unless you tell us where in the USA. It's a big country. And he says, how come debate moderators, this is presidential, I think he's talking about, are always talking head news people? Why not an historian, scientist, or even a distinguished retired politician? First of all, I think the Presidential Debate Commission's days are over, should be. I mean, there are better ways to do it. Open it up to a market. I don't have any problems. I actually before maybe having an historian or, you know, a scientist. I don't know. I think I just thought it'd be more free-flowing. They do that in the state level, and it works pretty darn well. And I'll tell you something else. I only staged one debate when I was at Bloomberg with the Washington Post in 2011. And we did one thing that people rarely do. We had the candidates question each other. They each got to ask a question of the other. It, you know, was so-so. It didn't work as well as we had hoped, but it's a good idea because it's revealing about the answer, but it's also revealing about the question.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, the candidates kind of pick the moderator. They can veto them. I mean, they don't just come in and say, and I think the presidential debate commission is an idea whose time has come and gone a long time ago. And I don't think the next Republican nominee may not debate. They don't care anymore, all right? They don't care. And, And it's the campaigns that, by the way, the campaigns are totally complicit in this because they get to write any rule you want.
They do.
Because they want They want to hold the thing. But they're not really debates. The campaigns want like a joint press conference. And that's what they turn into. We've lost the whole way. We've lost the idea of what they should be. One day we need to get Sidney on Blumenthal here and talk about the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And but man, it goes through the history of those and, you know, how many people went to them and how long they last and what they were like. And, you know, they have this sort of war in American presidential politics that most people don't understand. But when we close an election, we should do that because it's really illuminating as to kind of how all this started and what it's become. But the question is, it's a very sophisticated and question worthy to discuss. And the answers that we have are not good because, frankly, the thing is right. Not that good.
Anyway, Aaron, thank you for the question. It really is a good question. Tell us where you're from next time. Anyway, any of those we didn't get to, some very good questions. So please send them back because we'll try to get to them next week. We love this segment. Our audience is so smart. And they really ask very searching questions. So keep them coming. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors. Hold On Bags, Sleep Me by Chili Sleep, and Real Paper in the show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.